you have the chance to win a Spring Super Sweeps from LAist. Donate $60 for one entry to win a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Check out all the other prizes too when you donate now at laist.com/sweeps.
It's Film Week on KPCC. I'm Larry Mantle. Big week for movies, and to guide us through it is critic Christy Lemire. She's the co-host of the Breakfast All Day YouTube and podcast series and reviews films for RogerEbert.com. Andy Klein with us as well, and film critic for Animation Scoop and Animation Magazine, Charles Solomon. We begin with Black Panther: Wakanda Forever, the film starring Angela Bassett and Letitia Wright, Ryan Coogler, the director and co-screenwriter with Joe Robert Cole. Christy, please tell us about the new Black Panther.
So, for starters, nothing was ever going to, you know, meet or exceed the original Black Panther. It is probably the best Marvel Cinematic Universe film ever, and it was singular and it was groundbreaking. So they already had a tough challenge ahead of them. But then with the death of Chadwick Boseman a couple of years back, that made it even more so. So Ryan Coogler and company had a big task ahead of them. But this time around, we do begin with the death of King T'Challa. It's the absolute first thing that we see, is them mourning him. And how does the Kingdom of Wakanda go on without their Black Panther? Especially now when there is a threat from the outside. They thought they were always the only country that had this incredibly powerful and multi-useful substance known as vibranium, but they're not. There's a whole other kingdom, this underwater kingdom that also has it. And the kind of underwater sea creature named, well, he's played by Tenoch Huerta. He goes by many names, one of which is Namor. He comes to Queen Ramonda and says, look, we got to team up because the world's going to come after us and they're going to try to poach our vibranium. We got to help each other. And so it forces Wakanda to ponder their place in the world. But this also has to be an action film, but it's also about mourning Chadwick Boseman. And it's also about various other characters and other plot lines that tie this film into the larger MCU. The first Black Panther was singular and it stood on its own. It's one of its strengths, but now they have to connect to other, you know, parts of the MCU and also look ahead. And so you need to have seen like MCU TV shows to understand why certain characters matter. It's also 2 hours and 41 minutes long. Ooh. It is exceptionally well-crafted, as the first film was. You have the same production designer, Hannah Beachler, Ruth Carter's costume design is next level in terms of the variety of textures and the colors and the shapes and the details. Ludwig Göransson's score is quite transporting, but it feels really saggy in the middle. There are thrilling action sequences and really strong performances. This may be some of Angela Bassett's best work ever. She is ferocious and she also breaks your heart. Letitia Wright is great once again as Shuri, T'Challa's sister, the brilliant scientist in Wakanda. And she figures out what her role needs to be in the family and in the kingdom. Danai Gurira, who is the head of Wakanda's security force, she is fantastic. She's got a couple of really, really powerful scenes. So like everyone's good in this. Winston Duke is hilarious as M'Baku once again. Like all these pieces are there. And yet because this film has to function on so many levels for so many people in so many ways, it feels like a bit of a letdown here and there. Having said that, if you love the first Black Panther, and if you really miss Chadwick Boseman, they do a very beautiful and elegant job of memorializing him, both off the top and at the very end. You will cry. It is really powerfully emotional and in quite understated ways. And then the use of the Rihanna theme song, Lift Me Up, at the end also works. Oh, speaking of the end, you know, when you go see a Marvel movie, you've got to stay through the credits, right? If you've seen one, you know this, you got to stick through it. There's a really important mid-credit sequence, which moves the story forward, which changes a lot of what you just saw previously. There is not one at the very, very tail end, at least not at the screening that I went to. Perhaps when you go see it in a theater, it's different. But make sure that you at least stick through the mid-credit sequence. So kind of a mixed bag, but worth seeing if you saw the first one for sure.
Black Panther Wakanda Forever is rated PG-13 and it's in wide release. The Fabelmans, highly autobiographical film from Steven Spielberg. He co-wrote it with Tony Kushner, who frequently writes Spielberg films. This based on Spielberg's experience with his parents growing up in his household and taking to film very early on. Michelle Williams and Paul Dano star, Seth Rogen and Gabriel LaBelle in the cast as well. Andy, what do you think of The Fabelmans?
This is terrifically well made, which is no surprise at this point in Steven Spielberg's career. As far as I can tell, it does cleave very closely to the facts of his life. There are some incidents that I was not able to confirm in doing a little research, but he's allowed a little bit of license here, particularly a scene the scene that's going to get Michelle Williams an Oscar nomination, where she is realizing that he knows that she's been behaving badly and she's his mother. That's really moving. But most of it is actually very light in tone, very much upbeat. The teenage romance part is kind of silly but funny. There's some scenes of him being bullied for being Jewish, and that's kind of creepy to watch, although it resolves in an interesting way. Basically, this is, even though it is 2.5 hours long, it held me throughout, and the performances were generally really good. I mean, Seth Rogen is playing what's almost a dramatic role here, and he's fine. Paul Dano, who I normally can't bear, was perfectly cast as Spielberg's dad. And at the end, you have one short scene with David Lynch pretending to be John Ford, which is
that's
really
worth it just
hoot.
For that.
Yes.
I love
it. That's literally like the second to last scene in the film.
Oh, I love it.
So it is very enjoyable. I would say that I don't think, interestingly enough, on details, it's his most personal film. I still feel like E.T. and Close Encounters and all those, and you see in this sort of the roots of how he gets fascinated by this stuff. But I feel like in processing those into a more unreal story, that those are perhaps his most personal films.
That's interesting.
But this is great.
The Fabelmans, Steven Spielberg's new film. What did you think, Christy?
Yeah, I agree with Andy that E.T. does seem more revelatory and more vulnerable on his part. There's sort of a knowing kind of structural artifice here, which is surprising given that it is so much of his story. Yeah, this is a fascinating exercise here because it lulls you into thinking that it's going to be this warm and gentle nostalgic trip down memory lane with Spielberg reminiscing about his childhood. And in the beginning, when you see him go to his first movie, it absolutely is. You see him being wowed by the spectacle of it, but then it takes you into darker, heavier moments of his life, as Andy mentioned. And it's sort of a fascinating evolution as far as his relationship with film and with filmmaking, because as a little boy, he's just dazzled by the spectacle of it. The kid who plays his stand-in is just wide-eyed at his first experience seeing images on a big screen. And there's a cool sequence where Paul Dano, as his dad, who's an engineer, explains to him exactly how it is that he is seeing moving pictures before his eyes. And then as he becomes a teenager, and he's played by Gabriel LaBelle, who is excellent, by the way, he learns the power of storytelling and the power of knowing what to show and what not to show. And at first it's fun for him. It's all consuming, of course, but it's enjoyable. And then with the scene that Andy is referencing with Michelle Williams, he recognizes the power of manipulation in what you show and what you withhold and how he can really move people and provoke people. We see it again when he's a senior in high school with a seemingly innocuous film he needs to show for his senior class, and he gets the reaction that he wants, and he gets more than the reaction that he wants. And to see that dawning on him is very exciting. Yeah, this helped me too. And I kept thinking I needed to go run to the bathroom. I kept wanting to not leave. I'm like, oh, I gotta see what happens next, because it's exceptionally crafted, of course. The John Williams score is really unlike anything we have heard from John Williams in general, but especially in his collaborations with Spielberg specifically. And of course, the Janusz Kaminski cinematography and Rick Carter, the production design, like it's all people he's worked with before. Mark Bridges' costumes are fantastic. I found Michelle Williams' performance kind of over the top and mannered for the most part. And that is intentional, I guess, but it is when she brings it down and just lets things play across her face, as in that scene that Andy referenced, where it's like, oh, wow. Yeah, she's always just so good. Yeah, I was really, really impressed by it, but I wasn't necessarily moved by it the way I frequently am in Spielberg's films. But if you love him and you love his work and you want to see the seeds of where this titan of cinema came from, then this is definitely worth checking out.
The Fablemans is in wide release. It's rated PG-13. Guillermo del Toro's Pinocchio is stop-motion animation film, directed both by del Toro and Mark Gustafson. The film is streaming on Netflix starting in December, but currently can be seen at Lemley's Royal Theater in West Los Angeles. Charles, please start us off on Pinocchio.
This is actually the third Pinocchio we're getting this year. There was Disney's god-awful live-action remake earlier, and there's a Russian one coming later. This is very much a del Toro film. The visuals are extremely striking. He's darkened the tone from the Disney version that people know, which is in some ways keeping with the original book. He's added quite a number of elements to the story, some of which work. He's given Geppetto a backstory about why he wants a puppet son that's very effective. He's set most of it in fascist-era Italy, complete with a stop-motion puppet of Mussolini in a kind of Hunger Games camp for young fascist Italians that don't work so well. And I think the songs were a mistake, because the ones in the Disney film are just such classics, and these aren't on that level. But it is a very striking film, not surprising, from del Toro. There are bizarre visuals and exotic visuals and striking visuals. Some of it is scary. I would think it would be more appropriately PG-13 than PG. But it tells a very different story for Pinocchio, who's very clearly made from pieces of a tree. And he grows and learns and develops and matures. It's very moving. I was surprised at how moved I was by it. The animation is gorgeous. The puppets are by McKenna and Saunders, who also did them for things like Corpse Bride.
Oh, yeah.
And they're clearly at the cutting edge of this technology, and these puppets can give you nuanced expressions that, you know, years ago simply weren't possible. This is extraordinary animation. But what I liked most about the film is, unlike the kind of stay-press, pre-digested, vitamin-enriched products we've been getting in so many studio features, this is very much one man's vision and a story that he wanted to present a certain way. You may disagree with parts of that, you know, and I do. You may love parts of it, and I do. But it's the integrity of that vision and the power that it gives it that eclipses pretty much every other American animated film we've had this year.
Wow, high praise. Guillermo del Toro's Pinocchio. Andy?
I agree largely with Charles, and I liked it more than he did, possibly because I'm a very big del Toro fan. And this really does have, I'm always dubious about animated films that are directed by non-animators, but this is clearly his visual style. A lot of it is very dark. The poor cricket actually gets more abuse than anybody should have to get. But as usual, he likes to take a dig at fascism. And by resetting it, I think, for me, that worked. I don't think it worked for Charles so well. But it's gorgeous to look at. And I agree with Charles about the songs. That it's not like they were bad, but you keep thinking, where's When I Wish Upon a Star? And nothing can match that. So maybe they shouldn't have done it as a musical. But other than that, I think it's a fabulous film.
High praise for Guillermo del Toro's Pinocchio at Lemley's Royal Theater now. And then starting in early December, it'll be streaming on Netflix, rated PG, though Charles saying perhaps PG-13 would have been more appropriate. We have many more films to come on Film Week.
Imagine if you could charge your electric vehicle at the places you already love to eat, shop, and play. Whether you're at the movies, on your weekly grocery trip, or running errands at your local mall, Volta EV charging stations are built around your day-to-day and located in your community and nationwide. All you have to do is check in, plug in, and go about your day. It's EV charging made convenient. Download the Volta app to find your new favorite place to charge.
It's Film Week on KPCC. I'm Larry Mantle, joined by critics Andy Klein, Charles Solomon, and Christy Lemire. Busy week for movies. Next up is the musical comedy Spirited, starring Will Ferrell, Ryan Reynolds, and Octavia Spencer. Sean Anders, the director and co-screenwriter, based on Dickens' A Christmas Carol. Christy, what did you think of Spirited?
Yikes, it's very long. It's like over 2 hours long, and I don't know that it needs to be, and it just keeps ending. But it's a promising premise. You've got Will Ferrell and Ryan Reynolds doing all their own singing and dancing in a musical version of A Christmas Carol. You know, just the fact that these are not musical theater veterans by any stretch of the imagination, I kind of appreciate like the chutzpah of going for it, you know, stepping outside their comfort zones. These are two actors who are known for very particular screen persona. So for them to try something new is exciting in and of itself. And the songs are from the Greatest Showman guys. And so the musical numbers are very hit and miss, but it's a whole lot going on here. It's A Christmas Carol. And the target this time is Ryan Reynolds' character, who is this smarmy mercenary, like PR consultant. He kind of does political work and celebrity work and oppo research, and he has no ideology. He's all about winning. And Will Ferrell is the ghost of Christmas Present, who says, we gotta help fix this guy. You've got him listed here as unredeemable, but I can do it. I know I can do it. And so along with the ghost of Christmas Past, played by Sunita Mani, and the ghost of Christmas Yet to Come, who is voiced by Tracy Morgan, they all try and go and approach this guy, but he's like too smart for it. It's a very knowing, very meta, very au courant kind of comedy, because it's a movie that knows it exists in the pop culture world. And so you have references to other Scrooge movies, and you have references to like Judi Dench. And some of that is amusing. Again, it's all very hit and miss. And when it's big production numbers, about how this system works, it's sort of like an office musical comedy, the place where all of the choices come from of who to try to fix and who not. It can be very amusing. The big numbers are fun. There's one song in particular in which the phrase "good afternoon" is like the meanest put down you could possibly issue to somebody. That one number is really inspired, and that's where it's really firing on all cylinders. But it's very hit and miss as far as the musical abilities. I like Octavia Spencer here as a romantic lead, which she does not get a chance to do really ever, and probably has the best musical theater prowess of all of these, you know, non-musical type people. But it just keeps going, my goodness.
So I guess this, Christy, is the first official week of Christmas films, right, that we're getting in theaters. We haven't even hit Thanksgiving, of course. Spirited, based on A Christmas Carol. Andy?
I liked it more than Christy did, I have to say. I was very dubious at first, particularly because there were so many musical numbers. It's like in the first 20 minutes you have five major songs, and the songs are more memorable than the ones in Pinocchio, but still, you don't come out humming any of these tunes, particularly the way you would if it was Rodgers and Hammerstein. But it's very self-referential in a way that I found really worked, and referential around the original Dickens story and the characters of Scrooge and Marley, who figure into this in ways that I will not give up to you. But I actually was really amused by this and thought that it was well put together. It is too long, but nonetheless, it won me over in the end.
Seems like a fate of a number of films this week. We're into the too-long season.
Everything.
Spirited, the musical comedy rated PG-13. You can see it in theaters right now at the Regal LA Live and at the Regency Bruin. And then it starts streaming on Apple TV Plus next Friday, rated PG-13. All right, we're in the Christmas state of mind. Falling for Christmas, romantic comedy, starring Lindsay Lohan, Cord Overstreet. The film is directed by Janine Damian and written by Damian with Jeff Bennett. Christy, what'd you think of Falling for Christmas?
Lindsay Lohan is back, baby. Don't you even try to count her out or keep her down, because you can't. She is back, and it's really good to see her. I am rooting for her. This almost sounds like a parody of the kind of movie that plays all year round on Hallmark. You're saying, Larry, that this is Christmas movie season. You can find Christmas movies every day of the year, 24/7, if you look in the right places. So this is Netflix's version of a Hallmark Christmas movie. And it's like, it should hand out a checklist along with it when you watch it, because it's like, Lindsay Lohan is a spoiled hotel heiress who is about to get married to her vapid influencer boyfriend when a freak skiing accident leaves her tumbling down a hill and hitting her head and getting amnesia. And she can't remember who she is, but wouldn't you know, the hunky widower dad with an adorable daughter finds her and picks her up and brings her back to his charming and homey bed and breakfast lodge, which has been struggling financially. Lindsay Lohan's dad's played by Jack Wagner, and he owns the very fancy, sprawling, expensive resort in town. This is all shot like Park City-ish. And he owns the fancy resort, which is stomping out little mom and pop places like Cord Overstreet's little lodge. And so she doesn't remember who she is, but by doing simple things like making a bed for the first time in her life and, you know, helping out with things around the place, like dishes and cooking breakfast, she begins to realize what life truly should be like and what the Christmas spirit is really all about. So it sounds totally cliche, and it is, and it's not playing it for laughs. It's totally earnest, but it is so comforting. It's like exactly what you want it to be. And she looks great, and seems like she's doing well. And like, all of that is very encouraging. She still has really good comic timing. I mean, there are no surprises here. It absolutely goes exactly where you think it's going to, but like in a decent way, in a comforting, sweet way, not bad.
I was going to say, it's a comfort film. It sounds
completely
clearly.
Bundle up under the blanket on the couch and enjoy.
All right. Falling for Christmas, romantic comedy. It's streaming on Netflix, rated TV PG. The 22nd animation show of shows, comprising 10 short films, 9 of them recent productions, one a restored classic 1987 Oscar winner, The Man Who Planted Trees. Charles.
Well, this has become an important event for animation fans in this country. The Show of Shows highlights the work of independent artists, films that are getting attention on the festival circuit that people have trouble finding in this country, that there aren't a lot of showcases like this for them. Many of these films seem to be sort of a series of variations on different illustrative styles, on rather bleak themes. I very much liked Ties from Germany-Russia co-production, about a young woman trying to leave her family and finding she's still linked to them through both drawn lines and wire sculptures. And it's very clever technically, and I think works very nicely. I think the French film Empty Places and a Swiss film Average Happiness, I liked them. I would have liked them better had they been shorter. Several of these go on a little bit long, but the real star of the program is the man who planted trees, which is one of the most the beautiful, beloved, and honored animated films in the history of the art form, and with good reason. This is Frederick Bach's masterpiece, an ecological parable about a humble peasant who restores vast swaths of land in southern France by planting thousands and thousands of oak trees. And I was moved to tears when I saw its premiere in 1987 at Annecy. It still makes me cry every time I see it, from the sincerity of its message, the beauty of its work, and also the fact that now I still miss Frederick Bach so much. He was a good friend, but it is altogether a glorious film, and the chance to see it on a screen is not to be missed.
We're talking about the 22nd Animation Show of Shows, 10 short animated films. Andy?
I agree with Charles to a large degree. I mean, The Man Who Planted Trees actually didn't make me cry 35 years ago, and this time it worked for me much better, and it's a newly restored print, so it looks great. I thought that Empty Places was not too long. I found that one mesmerizing in a good sense of the word. And there were a couple that were essentially built around rhythm. Beyond No, which is masks from all over the world flipping it, and you see every culture possible all in about 3.5 minutes, something like 350 masks. Also Zoysoglyph, which was done by a 21-year-old French woman, that is, I don't even know quite how to describe it. It's like a visualization of sound in a way that turns into content after a while. It's very abstract at first, and then it kind of morphs into something else. And I found that fascinating and very hopeful from somebody that young.
We're talking about the 22nd Animation Show of Shows. One day only. It's at Lemley's Monica Film Center, Santa Monica, this coming Monday, November 14th. It'll also be one day only this coming Wednesday, November 16th, at Lemley's Glendale Theater. So Monday in Santa Monica at Lemley's, Wednesday in Glendale at Lemley's for the 22nd Animation Show of Shows. The comedy Sam and Kate stars Dustin Hoffman with his son Jake Hoffman and Sissy Spacek with her daughter Skylar Fisk. The film is written and directed by Darren LaGallo. Andy, what'd you think of Sam and Kate?
This is pretty good. And, of course, the casting thing is, I would say it's a trick, but it's a natural. You know, it just makes perfect sense. And Jake Hoffman is an artist who's sort of given up on his work and is working a junk job and gets a crush on Skylar Fisk, who is a bookstore owner and also has given up her art. She used to be a singer-songwriter for reasons that we don't find out until later. And their parents also then have an attraction. And it's sort of great to see Dustin Hoffman and Sissy Spacek together. I don't recall them being together in the past. But it does get very sad. I mean, I think this is a dramedy for sure. It does have funny moments. But it's a romantic story that goes through some really painful changes and quite well done.
Sam and Kate is the film. It's rated R, and it's at Lemley's Town Center in Encino. The animated adventure comedy My Father's Dragon is directed by Nora Toomey. The film's written by Meg LaFauve. Charles?
Well, of course, I'm a huge admirer of the work of Cartoon Saloon in Ireland. I've written 3 books about them, so I went into this, you know, with high expectations, of course. Nora Toomey directed the Oscar-nominated The Breadwinner, and it's based on a children's book that I loved as a little boy of the same title. They've changed the story quite a lot, which I think bothered me more than it would anyone else who sees it, because I just remember having it read to me and then reading it aloud myself and feeling so proud of that. It's about an adventurous, resourceful little boy who goes to help rescue an imprisoned little dragon. The animation is very stylized in the Cartoon Saloon way, nicely colored, well done. It's a good film. It does, however, skew younger than the other cartoon saloon features have. This is much more a younger children's movie than it is an adult film, as say Secret of Kells or Wolfwalkers or The Breadwinner were. So an interesting film and a good film. But, you know, I went into this with a lot of baggage, and probably if you didn't, you would enjoy it even more.
My Father's Dragon from Cartoon Saloon, rated PG, and it's streaming on Netflix. Christy, can you give us 30 seconds on the crime thriller Poker Face starring Russell Crowe, Liam Hemsworth, and RZA?
Yeah, Russell Crowe directed this and wrote the screenplay and stars in it as this tech billionaire who invites his childhood best friends over to his sprawling clifftop mansion for a night of poker. But he's got secrets in store for them because he wants to get information out of them, too. This would have been a straight-to-DVD thriller about 20 years ago, but it's got some style to it, some interesting camera work. I don't know why this is the movie of all the movies in all the world that Russell Crowe wants to direct, but it has some surprises here and there. It's okay. It's like a B movie.
All right. Poker Face is unrated, and it's at select Lemley theaters. Coming up, our John Horn interviewing writer-director James Gray about his highly autobiographical film, Armageddon Time. It's all coming up on Film Week right here on KPCC and always available wherever you get your podcasts or at kpcc.org.
The LAist Spring Super Sweeps is happening now. You can win amazing prizes while supporting your source for local fact-based journalism. One lucky grand prize winner will get to choose a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Other prizes include an electric bike from Juice Bikes and $1,000 gas gift cards. Your donation of $60 gets you one entry to win, and the more you give, the more entries you get. Donate now at LAist.com/sweeps.
It's Film Week on KPCC. I'm Larry Mantle. Great to have you with us. Writer-director James Gray's new film, Armageddon Time, is very much based on his own childhood and how his younger self experienced race, class, and family. The film stars Jeremy Strong and Anne Hathaway as the stand-ins for Gray's parents. Young Banks Rapida plays their school-age son. Our John Horn, host of the new podcast Retake from LA's studios, sat down with Gray. They were at the Telluride Film Festival in early September, where Armageddon Time premiered.
For people who are not Ronald Reagan-ologists, if that is such a thing, and there are probably some people who are not, what does the title mean? Or what does it refer to?
It's obviously derived really from a song that I first knew about from The Clash called Armageddon Time. Although it turned out to be not a song they wrote, it was a song written by Willie Williams, a reggae star. And I had heard the song many times as a 11 and 12 year old, and it sort of haunted my dreams. And of course, I thought that it had some kind of metaphoric power, particularly because the person who ran for office and wound up winning the presidency found it in his soul to talk about the end of days all the time. And it really scared the heck out of me as a kid.
No, I think what Reagan said is we may be living up to the Armageddon, like the world is going to end on my watch, more or less, I think this is how it came out.
Yeah, he seemed with almost religious fervor to talk about the end of the world, didn't he?
And this is a period of time where the Cold War is still going on, and are we still doing, you know, dive under your desk drills in elementary school?
A great question. The answer is we didn't, but if you remember, and I'm sure you do remember a bit of the history, the Russians had invaded Afghanistan. There was some kind of detente about 1973, and then again in about 1979, there were a lot of Soviet Jews that were allowed to leave to emigrate to the United States. But then Brezhnev invaded Afghanistan, and Carter had a kind of come-to-Jesus moment about the Soviet Union. And in 1980, I remember there was a kind of plunge into really frosty relations between the U.S. and the Soviet Union. It felt very scary to me.
No, and as a young kid, I think all of us knew it was like an existential threat over which we had no command or no control. Our lives, you know, we're becoming adolescents. We are starting to develop our brains, and there's this looming thing out there that is even more scary than girls. It's like, are we all going to die?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's not a new thing for the human race in a weird way, because if you were growing up in, you know, 1350 in Central Europe or Western Europe, you know, you had essentially something like a 40% chance, 50% chance of dying of bubonic plague, and you didn't know where you'd get it or how you'd get it, and the world seemed to be ending. So, unfortunately, our species has always dealt with the specter of annihilation, just in different forms. And that's why I don't think we're particularly special, but it doesn't mean it doesn't hurt.
And you would think that Armageddon Times might be a story about the Cold War or about detente or about the end of the world, but it's about a state of mind, isn't it? And how would you describe that state of mind?
I just felt that I felt the pressure of that as a young kid, and I don't think it's a healthy thing. You know, I'm not going to try and sell you some idea where children have always been protected through history and we have to protect the children. This is completely an ahistorical idea. You know, 7 or 8 year old boys were called powder monkeys and sent to fight, you know, on the hulls of the ships against Napoleon. So this idea that we've always protected children and we is nonsense. And yet, it is a cause of such profound stress and a kind of a little bit of damage that the world manages to do to these to children when you hear a presidential candidate talk about everything ending it all at once, and Carter spoke about it too, and it did seem existential. So, yes, very much so. I didn't want it to be, I mean, you hope it's not considered pretentious, of course. It's the worst thing. You're not allowed to be pretentious. You have to try. You have to aim for the stars. But, man, if you only hit Dresden, you're in big trouble.
When you started working on this film, you were inspired by what event? Was it during the pandemic? Was there something that caused you to say, this is the right moment to look backward?
No, actually what it was, to be candid, I had written it before the pandemic. I was alone in Paris in an I was doing Marriage of Figaro in Paris, and I at the opera, and I was, you know, I would do the rehearsals, which was in this weird bunker-like atmosphere with these marvelous singers. And then at I would go home, and it was almost like solitary confinement. I lived in a very residential area of Paris, and there was not much around. And I started to think that it was time for me to go back to what it is I loved about cinema. I was emerging from a very difficult period. I had made a film which was extremely tough on me, and a very hard film to finish for a variety of reasons.
What movie was that?
That was called Ad Astra. And it took a lot out of me, and at some point you can't help but admit that, you know, when you have your version and then there are 17 editors brought on and you have to fight for everything, that wears on you. So I had wanted to do something where I said, okay, strip away all the visual effects, strip away Amazonia, which was my prior film. Just go home again and see what you can come up with.
And at what point did it start to become the movie that you made?
Usually it takes me a long time, but this came together very quickly. I remember outlining it. I think it took 3 weeks to outline and then about 4 months to write it, which for me is extremely fast. Usually the outline takes a long time because that's the structuring of the story. The outline is 90% of the work. So this time the outline came together very quickly because it was just essentially a segment or a section of my life that was about 2 to 3 months in duration, and all of a sudden the details started pouring out.
Did you find that your recall was greater than you imagined it would be, or was it prompted by looking at old letters or photos? I can't remember what I was doing when I was the age of your character in your film, but you clearly have very specific memories.
It's a great question. The answer is a little bit of of both, although I do have a very good memory of my childhood, and I will tell you that a huge source of information was my brother, with whom I'm very close. And my brother has fantastic recall. So I would say to him, what were the plates? Do you remember the plates? And he would say, well, the plates in the kitchen? Yeah, they were white, and they had a little green floral pattern around. Oh, okay. And it was that kind of specificity that he could recall. He was better than any photographs or letters or anything like that. And, in fact, my father and mother took hundreds and hundreds of photographs.
People could look at this movie and say, this is a story about how a young boy became an artist, or how his creative mind started to develop, or the events in his life that started to make him the person that he came to be as an adult. Or he could say, this is a portrait of a family and a kid who is rebellious and going through a difficult period trying to find himself and his friends and an identity that's separate from his parents. Did you ever think that it had an organizing theme about what it was saying more broadly about where you are today?
Well, I tried to remove, how do I put this, an idea of myself as the hero of the story, and that it was some kind of coming of age where it's all about me and I become the great man. That to me is, frankly, slightly nauseating. And what I had wanted it to be, really, was about this kid in the world, and he reflects only a world in a state of great turmoil, and that the different layers of oppression and class and all of these intersecting historical things would come together to form a kind of portrait of a time.
We'll continue with John Horn's conversation with writer-director James Gray of the film Armageddon Time in just a minute. It's Film Week on KPCC. I'm Larry Mantle. Let's return to our John Horn's conversation with writer-director James Gray. His new feature is Armageddon Time.
I want to ask you about specificity. I don't know how many people other than me, because I had one, noticed that Paul is carrying a $6 million man lunchbox. It's a fleeting shot. And I was like, I had that lunchbox. You are very specific. You talked about like what the plates were like in your house. And you have two actors, Jeremy Strong and Anne Hathaway. And I don't know how they work, but I can guess that they want specifics too. They want to know what your parents were like because they have to build a character on that. At what point do you give them a lot of information? At what point do you not? How do you let them create their own performance, their own character that isn't as specific as the $6 million man lunchbox, but is nevertheless true to how your parents were?
It's a marvelous question, and the way that I tried to approach it, because it is a challenge. The reason it's a challenge is you don't want actors like that doing an imitation of your parents. What you want is it's almost like a fantasia on your youth. It's not the facts on the ground aren't exact in all cases, although in some cases here in the movie they are, but in a lot of cases. But you try to say, here are the details that you ask me for. But you try to focus on the spirit of the soul of the person more than the specifics. You give them as much as they ask for. I never gave them more than that. And what I did try to do is I would say, trust me on the set, on the surroundings, and I would walk them through the set. So just feel what this is.
This would be a classic example of hearsay, but I'm going to quote something that Anne Hathaway said that you said. So, but I think it's really telling. about how one has to look at the past without judging it and allowing the pain that has been caused to be used as a positive force in the present. How does that apply to this?
Most people, not everybody, of course, but most people are trying to do their best to live their life and try to manage things. And I think the purpose of art is not to focus on how much better you are and how much more ethical you are than the subjects of the work. I think that's folly. I prefer to focus on, instead of look at those idiots, maybe it's we are all idiots, you know? There's a big difference. And a level of condescension sometimes creeps into the work when the creators have a certain narcissism. And I've tried to break that down. I've tried to wreck that and say that it's not about judging others. It's about embracing our weaknesses. Because that's the only path forward. You're not going to make any kind of, dare I say, progress. If all you do is say, you know, I'm good and you're nothing, that's a dark place.
There is a beacon of love and compassion and fairness in this film, and it is Anthony Hopkins' character who's playing the grandfather in this story. And he dispenses not only loving and kind words, but words about tolerance and words about not judging other people and fighting back against people who judge people based on, in this case, the color of their skin. I want to ask you about the truth of that character and your grandfather and what he meant to you. And did he say those kinds of things?
He did. He was a marvelous person. You know, it's interesting with children. As parents, you only have to be kind of good enough. And if one person lets you know that you're wanted, you'll probably be okay. And for me, that was my grandfather. He was a very urbane, very beautiful person who had a tremendous awareness of the world, a kind of a real perception of how things worked. And, you know, he has his flaws in the movie, too. He's the one who suggests and pays for, ultimately, the move that Paul makes to a private school. And in that way, does his own little bit to contribute to an unequal society. But he was that guy. I mean, Tony actually does capture him with great clarity. He was very much like that. I have a great resistance to people who like to picture a New York Jewish grandfather in this kind of like, hello, and they listen, and I'm this guy, and they talk like this, and they have a big nose. You know, to me, that's very stereotypical and offensive. And he captures my grandfather.
There is a moment in this film, when I first met you up here, we had a brief conversation about the truthfulness or the factualness of however you wanted to define it of this film. And you said it's, I don't know, 99% true. And I said, including, and I'll be vague about this, the scene where something is stolen. And you said, not that one. So we don't have to get into what was or was not stolen. But what you told me was fascinating was the part of the plan of stealing something involved a trip to Florida.
Yeah.
Please explain that idea, which is not represented in the movie.
Well, we do mention it about going to Epcot Center. I mean, Epcot was being... I can't believe I'm saying this. It's so crazy. Epcot Center was being built, and Disney was billing it as a new, amazing thing. And I loved Walt Disney World. I mean, you know, I was 12 years old or whatever, so that was exciting to me. And it's madness. I thought, that's paradise. You go down to Florida and you hang out at Walt Disney World, and now there's Epcot Center, and that's all kinds of new opportunities for a 12-year-old.
I mean, so you were going to travel. How far was the trip?
Well, I would have had to go, 1,100 miles in a bus.
As a 12-year-old, financed by maybe the fencing of stolen property? That was the idea?
I understand that it's the dumbest thing ever, but...
But you believed it.
I was 12, and what do you want from me? I was 12 years old. I thought it was a good idea.
Some people, and I guarantee you, my wife who's watching this movie now, have a really difficult time with children in peril. And there are moments where the children in this film are in peril, and it's difficult to watch, and it's scary. What was your idea about the dangers that were faced? And you obviously want to be true to the spirit of you want to be true to history, but people can get very scared and distracted when the idea is the peril rather than how the person in peril is processing.
You can either create a world that you wish that it were, or you can try to represent as sincerely and honestly the world as you think and you see that it is and was, and maybe will be. That's all you have. If you remove that sense of peril, you're left essentially with a kind of commercial for American capitalism. It's like how great everything is. And I'm not really interested in doing that. I don't think you have any other option as a member of the creative community to put forth as honestly and sincerely that your ideas as you can. I understand that may not be a great answer for your question, but I don't think as creative people we have a choice. You have to show it.
James, thanks so much. Great
Thank
to see you.
Thank you, John.
That's our John Horn in conversation with writer-director James Gray. His new feature is Armageddon Time in theaters now. And you can find John's new podcast, Retake, wherever you get your audio. This week, he talks with German filmmaker Edward Berger, who just adapted the classic German World War I novel, All Quiet on the Western Front. That's it for Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle. Have a wonderful weekend.
Hey, it's Brian, the host of How to LA, a podcast that is a love letter to Los Angeles. Independent movie theaters are having a glow-up moment.
Vidiot's and Eagle Rock, amazing. We have our friends at the American Cinematheque. The Vista just reopened.
In our new series, Revival House, we'll take you inside these spots and share their history. Because movie history is LA history. Listen to Revival House on How to LA wherever you listen to podcasts.